All right, I think it's time to commence with the show. Our first speaker has kicked off our clinic now for a number of years, and we're very fortunate to have him back again to do it for us this year. Bob Surrett has been the Director of Sales Engineering with Shively Labs since 1981 and has been involved with the design and development of broadcaster antenna systems since 1974. He is currently a senior member of the IEEE, a member of the SBE. He has authored a chapter on filters and combining systems for the latest edition of the CRC Electronics Handbook and the 9th and 10th edition of the NAB Handbook. Please welcome Bob Surrett.
Good morning. Thank you for all coming. It's always a pleasure to be here. I feel more comfortable down here on the floor because I've got a pointer and you can't really do that from there, so I hope you don't mind. Last year, I did a talk on filters. Let's see if I make this work. All right. There you go. Okay. Last year I did a talk on filters, and I, because it was the first time through, I had a lot of information. I went very quickly, and this time thing here said I was out of time when I was not finished. So in talking with Terry, he said, well, why don't you come back and do part two? And I said, well, okay, because we have a couple of new things. So the question I have to ask, did everybody remember last year's talk?
Sure,
okay. Last night I said, Terry, I was gonna ask for a show of hands. He said, nobody's gonna do that because you're gonna ask them a question. And so I'm not gonna have a quiz. I'm gonna start again. And then if I've got a little time left over, I'm gonna talk about antenna maintenance. And it's becoming a larger and larger issue nowadays because the equipment's getting older. Broadcasters hate to spend money. If they can't see a tower, can't see an antenna, they just think it's going to last forever, and unfortunately they're wearing out. So I'll add that as kind of an afterthought to what I'm going to do. I started last year with this. Here it is. This is a bandpass filter, three-cavity bandpass filter. It's basically the modern design. I think there's only one company that still makes round cavities. They do have a new style that's square. We've been making square filters longer than I like to remember. But we take and we have a loop, puts energy in. We have a slot or iris up here. And this is the head of the filter system, and we loop couple out. Energy in, energy out. When we tune a filter, we take and want to make it so that it's very symmetrical. The law, if you do it, when we normally set a filter up, and it doesn't matter what frequency, but it's all within the FM band, we usually set it so that at 800 kilohertz, you get approximately 16 dB of isolation. And on a 24-inch cavity with 16 dB of isolation, you have just under a quarter dB loss. So you can put 30 kilowatts into a big filter and really not have that much power being dissipated in the filter. And then we look at the VSWR. I could have put a Smith chart up, and last year I did. But it basically shows that same symmetry. It stays well below 1.1 to 1 for approximately plus or minus 200 kilohertz, and then it climbs very quickly. So it comes into resonance and it goes out of resonance, and it filters all other frequencies in the appropriate area. Go back there. Last year when I showed this slide, I did it for 1/4 of a cycle. And a couple of people asked, well, is that really what it looks like? And so this year, in order to make it a better demonstration on it, I took it and got it so we're going to show a full cycle. So if energy comes in here and is in that resonant circuit, the currents are going in this direction. When they hit that iris, and it's kind of hard to see, there's a little line there and a little line there. I just couldn't make it any darker than that. But what's happening is here is this current flow here is causing current to go in this direction. So there's a transfer of energy in here, and these are basically electrically a quarter wave apart. So you end up with that, I don't know how to say it, the conversation of conservation of energy from here in this direction going here. It induces that to go here, and then you're going to get that current coming back here. So if I progress this one, you'll see how this starts to fade, this starts to peak as we go through it. Another cycle. Another cycle. And what's happening here is this color, if you will, is the strength of the currents, this magnetic field, the strength of the field. And you'll see that this here has a darker red than this. And that's because this coupling mechanism, this iris or slot coupling mechanism, has a different characteristic. So I tried to describe the value of Q last year. It says the Q of this. Oh! All right, how's that? Well, it's either you guys are all paying attention or this just woke you all up. I'm not sure which. Okay. So, what did I do anyway? That's real. So the intensity of this it's a result of the difference in Q between here and here. And I take it the next way, and what's going to happen is when this one here comes to the bottom of its cycle, this one here is at the peak of its cycle, and then we start going backwards. So this here is starting to decay. This one's going to start building as this one over here is doing the same thing. So we go through a complete cycle, and then the currents are going to go back in the other direction. And this all happens within, nanoseconds or what that is. That's a complete slow motion description of what's happening inside a filter, and then I turn this on. So it builds, it reduces, and then it goes in the other direction. Now I think we have time, so if somebody sees something and say, hey, that doesn't look right. Because last time I did this, somebody said, it looks like it's going backwards. I said, no, it can't be. But it actually does. Okay?
When you say a difference in Q, is it a large difference, a small difference?
The Q of a filter, a 24-inch filter, theoretically is around 2,000. We've only measured in the 12,000, 2,000. We're down the 1,200 region. So the difference between here and here is a Q of about 1,200 to 1,500. It's a little bit higher, and that's because of these things, these coupling through, and it generates more energy. Actually, I shouldn't have said that. The Q is higher, so it goes that way. And here's everything I've been showing you is the magnetic fields that circulate in the filter. Here are the electrical fields that emanate out from the interconductors. And it has the same kind of thing. They go out, they expand, they decay, and they change direction. And there are them together. It's a very complex system that's inside those filters. What's amazing is that when I started this doing filters you try to visualize, whether it's an antenna or a filter, you try to visualize what's happening to the energy in through it. And I, back in the days when I was learning, I had to do current probes and things like that to see where they are, and you look at textbooks. It took a half hour for a computer to generate this. It just amazes me. And this is kind of stuttered, but it's okay, because it's just a different presentation of what's happening inside that filter in both electrical and magnetic fields. I'm going to point out, back in the 70s and early 80s, we used round filters. Theoretically, you would take a filter, and the optimum impedance for a filter, the most efficient transmission mode in a filter, is at 77 ohms. And so we always made the inner conductor, outer conductor, so it'd be 77 ohms. And in a round filter, that's what it is, and those where the currents are, circular all the way around. When we first came up with square cavities, so we could use an iris or a slot through it, we made measurements. We actually put radial little holes and used a probe, current probe, to look at the currents inside the filter. And we did. We found that they were exactly the same. What surprised us is it never went to the corner. We just said, we can't, it's so low we can't measure it. Well, look what the computer did. It's amazing. The currents are actually straight. It doesn't bend into that corner. It just goes by the corner. So there's actually no current, or very little current, in the corners. Now, as the industry has progressed, maybe, I'm not sure progressed or regressed, but now we're doing low-powered stuff. Everybody wants 100 watt, or 200 watt, or 300 watt. They want low-powered filters. And they want them to do the same thing that a high-powered filter will do. Well, in a way, now that filter, I said I wasn't going to go back, but I did. This filter here is called an interdigital filter. Now, you can use different mechanical methods of filters. This is an interdigital filter. You can use Butterworth filters. You can use comb-line filters. They all have their own characteristics. This one being an interdigital filter, we have a input of energy here, and this is a probe that goes in this direction. So you direct couple energy here. The last probe also is direct coupled. The third probe, the center probe, is here, and it's grounded on the bottom, and you'll see how that differs. A comb line filter would have all three in the top, like the 24 inch. It's also an open space, but the coupling mechanism to that filter is different than it is in an interdigital filter. Well, it's a different scale, but we did the same thing. We went to 800 kilohertz, and it's hard to read, but that's 16 dB, got the same slope, symmetrical tuning, everything's great. The trouble is, or not trouble is that because you've gone smaller, you're trying to get the same characteristics out of a smaller filter, the insertion loss goes up. And in the first one, with a 24-inch, the insertion loss was less than a quarter of a dB. On a 4-inch wide interdigital filter, the insertion loss is a full dB, trying to get the same characteristics. Same VSWR curve, very, very low, very nice match, but it takes off very quickly. So a bandpass filter is a bandpass filter, no matter if it's round or square or rectangular, they basically all respond the same way, doesn't matter who makes them. So when you have an interdigital filter, where the probe here is grounded on top, grounded down the bottom. It almost looks identical to what we saw with the 24-inch. The currents rotate here. There's a boundary here. There's no mechanical boundary. It's just a coupling an RF boundary between the two. And the way you tune these filters is the spacing of where these probes are. If you have, you don't need a lot of filter, you put these close together so there's a lot of coupling. If you need more filter, you put them separated and you make the box bigger. Same type of thing, the insertion loss goes up. Those are the electrical fields. Same thing that happens with the larger filter. And when I show you this, those are the H fields or the magnetic vector, the magnetic fields. So it's grounded on top, grounded on top, grounded here in the bottom. And so they're different. But you see the Q of this system here is different, the Q of these, so the currents, and so if you've got a three cavity bandpass filter and you put your hand on the middle cavity, you say, oh my God, there's something wrong here. Because it's not, the two end ones are fairly, they're cool and the middle one's hot, or you've got a lot of power, the end ones are a little warm and the middle one get pretty hot. You know, you can put your hand on 120 degrees and say, well, that's a little stingy. A lot of people say, whoa, that's too hot. But 120 degrees is kind of typical for a three-cavity filter. We've had them go as high as 140 degrees, which are, don't touch. It's when your oils of your hands start to melt that you have to worry about that. But it turns out that the filters are compensated and a little heat doesn't bother them. They're very stable. And those are the electrical fields. And they're the same, but because we're grounded down here and it's an interdigital filter, if you looked at a cone line filter, what they do is all three of these probes are at the top, and you actually couple the energy here, and there are coupling strips that go by the system. And there are them together, both vectors. Again, it's a very complex mechanism that happens inside of a bandpass cavity. Sir?
Do you have to preheat the cavities before you tune them, or can you cold?
No, for us, we use an Invar interconductor. And an Invar rod changes 0.00 something per degree of temperature rise. So the interconductor length is the tuning mechanism. This length, oh, I wanted to go back. This, wrong hand. This length from here to the end is the frequency determining factor of the filter. The spacing here and where these loops attach is the coupling through the filter. So if these here do not move, or they move very, very little, then it doesn't matter what happens to the outside. The outside can get bigger, get smaller. The impedance might change a little bit. Instead of 77 ohms, it might be 77.5, but we're talking about very small numbers here. So if you tune them at, you know, in Maine, this time of the year, the factory floor is probably what, 60 degrees, 65 degrees? As long as you're not under the heater. If you're under the heater, it's hotter than that, but in the general floor area, it's probably 60-something. And you turn them on and go to whatever, it's 40 degrees above ambient is usually what they go for. We've tested them from stone cold to 140-degree outer temperature. They may detune a little bit, but not something you notice. Shouldn't have to. If you have a filter like that that changes, then usually there's something stuck. We've seen that with some of the older filters that are, you know, you get a filter that's 20 plus years old that hasn't been moved in 20 years. The end of the probe is a dome, so it doesn't arc. and you'll find that they're stuck on the spin on the contact. So if you just give it a little touch, it'll release it and go back to that standard heat stabilized condition. Come on. There you go. That's again the computer sense. Last year I said, you know, I try to visualize these. Now, I didn't want to imply that I took LSD back in the 60s, but, you know, for those people who did, that's a hell of a presentation. What we did in order to, and this is where I took this, changed the slides this year. We used to actually make notch filters and attach them to a series of bandpass filters. Well, we had a young fellow that was into filters, and he said, well, you know, if you put a feedback, if you put a loop in here and the energy flows in over to here, you take that energy and it puts a null, just like a notch filter in the system. And you can get very deep. If you got a big filter system, you get a very deep null. You get a smaller system, it doesn't go so deep. Again, it's all mechanics. It's that physical strength. And that's one side. And if you literally turn the loops 180 degrees in their sockets, guess what? The null goes on the other side. So you can make a branch combiner with the same hardware, three cavity filter with feedbacks, and you can get, you know, 800 kilohertz is no big deal. If you need something more than that, you do four cavities and put new loops, and with a four cavity symmetrical filter, if you put feedbacks from the one to the end, you actually get two nulls, one on each side, and you kind of try to approach a square wave. As you put those numbers in, what happens is the insertion loss goes up a little bit. The first time we made a feedback loop filter, we calculated that with a 20 kilowatt transmitter through, you would have 200 watts going across the loop. Well, it took, how long will an RG213 cable last with 20 kilowatts in it? I think it just poof. I wasn't there, but they came back and said, hey, your filter burnt up. And we never heard of such a thing. How could the filter? They said, no, the cable between. And we went, uh-oh. Well, what happens is there's actually, you have to get that precision position of the loop so that the energy going through that cable is not zero. You want isolation going. You don't want a complete loop, no insertion, no loss, so you get 20 kilowatts. So what we shoot for is around 10 dB of isolation. And that's about all you get. The smaller the cavity, the less the isolation. So you shoot for 10 dB. So if you got 20 kilowatts running through it, you only have 2 kilowatts running through this cable. So instead of an RG213, we went to 7/8 or inch and 5/8. But it was an eye-opener to see that just go bang, and it just was, and say, well, that was stupid. And there is the in VSWR curve, which is virtually the same. We've added a notch in the system. We've made the frequency response curve non-symmetrical by adding a notch, but we really haven't hurt the response of the filter or the VSWR. And that's the next step, is that we needed a filter that would give us more isolation at 400 kilohertz. The FCC, in its wisdom, said, you know, we can put translators on the air at 400 kilohertz. And it used to be they wouldn't do anything at less than, you know, 800 kilohertz is all you got. And you could do 800 kilohertz in your sleep. At 400 kilohertz, you have to do something special. In the 24-inch cavities and the 16-inch cavities, you have to reduce the coupling through the cavities a lot. You've got to approach that square wave. And I have not seen or heard of a 400 kilohertz full facility. You don't put 20 kilowatts at 400 kilohertz on the same antenna. The receivers just won't deal with it, I don't think. But at less than a kilowatt, where we use the smaller filters, the only way to make the filter, we couldn't make the filter larger to get that coupling less and less and less. So what we did is we added post between the interconductors, two there and two there. We found that it depends on where you put those posts, you could reduce the isolation. We put posts there instead of a wall, because the wall would have lots of isolation. It would be too much decoupling with a wall. And then you have to say, how do I make my coupling if you're going to do that with mechanical walls, you have to have all three interconductors. So an interdigital filter doesn't lend itself to having walls. It wanted studs. So we did that. We put post. Let's see what it says next. Well, the post didn't give us enough isolation and said, well, what if we put feedback loops and on a three-cavity filter? What can we do with that? And what we did with that is get on one side, now that's two megs, so each division is 200 kilohertz. So there's your passband, and you can see where that's not quite flat anymore. When we made this symmetrical, this was flat, and it came out and then went down to 800 kilohertz notch. The other thing here is we caved that in, so at 400 kilohertz, you have 37 dB of isolation. It's not great, but at a kilowatt or less, when you put it into a branch, because when you do branch filters, you get another 6 dB of attenuation through the branch T. So we're looking at 43 dB of total isolation when you're doing 400 kilohertz. The other thing that happened is that instead of this being symmetrical with here, so we got 37 here, and on this side, we only got just over 10 dB of isolation on the other side. So we gained isolation in one direction, and we lost it on the other side. And then we went to the other frequency, changing the loops. All right, do that. There you go. Oh, and that's the VSWR curve. Now, here's plus or minus 100, and there is the 200 mark. So what's happened is because we are so close to the resonant at 400 kilohertz, we've disturbed that symmetrical curve. But it's still, we're talking at plus or minus 100 and something under 1.1, and at 200 kilohertz, it's like a 104, like that. We used to maintain, or I was taught, that you always had minimum VSWR, absolute minimum. Nobody likes VSWR. Well, because of IBOC and all the advances in transmitters, I think if you talk to a transmitter manufacturer, and I don't see them out there, you'll find that the transmitters are better and better and better, and they don't need to have that very low, I don't think. Maybe I'm not a transmitter guy. But I think you'll find is if you're under 1.15 to 1, plus or minus 200 kilohertz, the transmitter doesn't care. That's what I've kind of come around to. And when we did the other side at 400 kilohertz, we only got 30 dB, which was a little disappointing. So when you put that into a T, you only get 36 dB of isolation. This actually works on site. We didn't have to add any more filters. but this was our first shot at 400 kilohertz. And on that side, there's lots of distortion, but it's still, we're under 115 for plus or minus 200 kilohertz. Okay? Let's see what's next. Questions? Oh, good. Any questions on filters? Okay. Part two went off gay. Okay, there you go. He's not leaving on me. Oh, he's got a question. The microphones came out. There we go. Like last year.
Turn them on.
Turn them on. Nobody has a question. We're good then.
On?
Yep. Okay, anybody out there? There we go. Through that, that's fine. I'll be around if people have, oh, we got one. Aha. If you wait long enough.
Probably, this is probably privileged information, but when you put that feedback loop in, you were coupling from the grounded end to the grounded end. I'm guessing that the actual connection was on the other end down through the center probe, or were you able to do somehow to?
The actual loop, there's actually a loop inside the cavity that's about 6-8 inches long.
Oh, so it's actually a loop. It's actually a feedback loop, and then you also have your input and output loops.
That's correct.
So it's additional loops. Okay, cool.
Yeah. I might point out, and there's people who would hear about it, in Italy, a company put 6 cavities together. They made a kind of a square. And they have feedbacks between 1 and 3 and 2 and 4. And they're getting notches at plus or minus 300 kilohertz. But it's a lot of cavity. And they're saying that the insertion loss is no worse than the 3 or 4 cavity filters. So I've just heard about it. 300 kilohertz is, I just don't think a receiver can deal with that, but I'm not sure. Anyway, anything else? Yes, sir.
So 37 dB down at 400 kilohertz out, that's a nice number, but aren't we supposed to hit 80 down?
Well, if you depends on the transmitter. I hate transmitters. Hate them, hate them, hate them. Real quick, I started doing filters in 1973 with Ed Shively. And like back then, I had to learn what happens to them. So in 1973 until last year, I have never had a combined filter allow spurs to go through. Never, except for last year. A transmitter with 45 dB of isolation, there was enough energy there that the transmitter picked it up. It was a low-power transmitter. It picked it up, and because of that non-symmetry in that curve I talked about, then the spur came out, and instead of being 80-something dB down, it was 70-something dB down. We added an extra filter, and it went away. Most transmitters, and I used to say this, if you took 10 transmitters of any manufacturer and put had 40 dB of isolation, some of the transmitters would generate spur and some wouldn't. It's just not enough energy in the cavities to pick it up. Now you do solid state. Tubes were easy, you know, you did that in college, you had good currents and you had plate currents and it was easy. Then they did transmitters and did Hall's flow, and now they're doing FETs and they're doing, I don't understand it. Can't visualize that, what's happening inside of a solid state transmitter. So it really depends on how efficient that transmitter is adjusted. My understanding is the transmitter that we put our combiner into, they made it as efficient as they possibly could, and when they did that, any slight amount of energy would generate spurs because it's a non-linear device. It wants to generate out-of-band energy, and it did. What they did is they cut back the efficiency a little bit, and it stopped doing that. So between the transmitters and the filters and stuff. So right now at 40, a little over 40 dB, you do the math, and it comes out the other side as long as it's needed. Now, if you've got a 1 kilowatt ERP with 80 dB down, your weight, the receivers don't pick that up. So in general, it works out pretty well. Sir?
I assume the 400 kilohertz filters are a fairly recent thing with all the recent translator activity. Roughly how many of those do you have in service?
Actually, not that many. I look at it as at 400, because used to be at 800 kilohertz, if you had a station 100 miles away and it just happened to get into your at 400 kilohertz away, it would cause receiver problems. The receivers, and I'm not sure the word is, but receivers having the selectivity of the receivers is such they have trouble with close-in frequencies, and they generate their own spurs. When somebody comes and said, we want to do 400 kilohertz, I usually say, are you sure you want to do 400 kilohertz? And with translators, I mean, it's getting crowded anymore. But in most cases, somebody says, well, I can go to a different site with a different frequency and say that's better. 600 kilohertz is better than 4. 800 is better than 6. We have probably 3 in the country that's at 400 kilohertz, and they seem to work. No one's if you don't hear anything, it works, right? It's one of those. No news is good news, and unless you really pick it up. But I don't know what other manufacturers are doing. I know that in one case we lost an order. It was done by a different manufacturer, somebody who used to do low-powered stuff. We buy their notch filters a lot, the little tiny things. They went to 1,000 watts. And after it was installed, they had to add extra cavities because they couldn't get the isolation. And you've got to have that 40 in the 40 dB range. I have to move on because it's interesting. I wind me up and I just talk. Okay, so I put this up. I'm going to go into maintenance, I guess. I go on and on about simple stories, but here is a shot of one of our antennas. It has de-icers because it's a wind load issue. And I wanted to show you this, the colors. What do the colors kind of indicate in the fall of the year, right? It's the fall, kind of leaves are changing. I blew it up, and that piece of white stuff is actually the mechanical hold that goes across the horizontal arms to hold it so it doesn't bend back and forth. So that means that it got broke. Now, either the guy who painted the tower used that as a stepping stone. Can you imagine? Oops! Or it got hit by a piece of ice. So if it got hit by a piece of ice, and these are yellow leaves for foliage, then it kind of implies that it was taken this year and that ice fell last winter. So that says that they didn't inspect the antenna until September, which was a month ago. Instead of going, geez, guys, because something must have happened. The transmitter might have shut down, might have not, but something must have happened last winter and nobody noticed it. And whether they happen to go up, maybe the tower painter said, hey, oh, by the way, I saw something. No inspection when it's summertime. Guess what they're doing this week? They're forecasting snow. So it really is important that you inspect, have the owners inspect the towers, I believe, once a year. It only makes sense, and you do it in the spring. We have an antenna on Mount Washington. It's been there for 20 years. We actually have two. It turns out, we didn't know this, it turns out that they lost air in the main antenna in January. They couldn't get to the site until June. So they were on their backup antenna for 6 months. The only difference is on Mount Washington, on the full antenna, on Route 495 in Massachusetts, on the full antenna, it locks. With a standby antenna, it doesn't. You can tune it in, but it doesn't lock on the search. That's 100 and some crazy miles away, and it's a 50 kilowatt ERC. 50 kilowatts at 6,800 feet. Goes forever. But anyway, they didn't do the maintenance on that until the 1st of September. They hit a day with no wind. It was crazy. Instead of doing it in June. But anyway, we go on and on and on. I threw this slide up. It might be a little hard, but there's a little coloration there, little light there. The other thing is see this here? They're copper straps. And this is an installation where they had no room on the tower, so they put two antennas back to back and uses filters and all that stuff. But the interesting part there's one of those straps there. What happened to the other straps? Where are they? Well, I blew it up, and yes, there's a strap there. And yes, there's a coloration there. And yes, there's a little coloration there. So what happened the last time it got hit by lightning? Melt. Well, I said the last time. But what does that look like? Duct tape.
Looks like duct tape.
So, maintenance was duct tape. Okay. Temporary. And then you've got this big hole here. And here's one of the other bays. And, you know, somebody said, well, that means the top of the arm of the radiator arced. And if the top of the arm had arced, that would have been black. That's just absolutely evaporated. That's poof, it's gone, right? There's no black, there's no nothing. That's just blown off. Here's one, it's kind of hard to see. Let's see, there's an elbow there, and 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 whoops, duct tape. We gotta love it, right? We need to be in the duct tape business, I think. You get a call and say, you know, it's not holding pressure. Well, how long? I don't know. What's the VSWR? I don't know. When was the last time you went there? Anyway, so we had to go check what it was, and if you have to use your imagination a little bit, but what it looks like here is that this is the end of that piece, which is an elbow. Does it look like that's 90 degrees? It's kind of hard to tell, but it's different. We thought, well, what it turns out is they didn't put the hardware in to hold the cables they were supposed to, and that snapped off, just right off. Here's another one. We got a standing wave, we've got pressure. How long ago? For a while. Nobody knows. This is kind of hard to see, but this is the high temp non-jacketed cable where you have to be very careful where you put it so you don't get arcing between the cables and stuff like that. That's full of holes. That's stainless steel. That's a 16th inch stainless steel tube. How do you throw an arc in that? You know, just bang. It's hard to do that, but there's a little pit because there was a cable that ran across here, and back in here, that's your typical hose clamp clamping it, and this cable here, whatever happened to its loose, its confinement or its cabling clamps, it let go, and that arced right in here, just RF inside the antenna. Here's another case. They had two cables. There's not really a lot of burn there, really, but there are two cables side by side, and they moved. You know, friction. When was the last time you inspected the antenna? Well, I don't know. It amazes me. Here's a case where, somebody should have just looked, before it actually fell off. But hey, you get a call. My signal changed. I don't have the same coverage as I had. Did you have a storm? Well, we did have this microburst. Nobody talked about microburst before. I have one of those garages, those canvas garages that you put anchors into the ground and done like that. And the damn canvas rotted, so I put a tarp over it that didn't go to the ground. So there was air, and it was all pinned like that. We had a microburst go through. It lifted it up into the air and flew it into the backyard. So it happens. Never saw it before. So, things happen. Now, the thing that you have to do is maintain towers. Doesn't matter what they are, you got to maintain them. And when you get a tower that falls down, this is a cell tower with all the stuff on it, and this, it's hard to see, is the tower, guide tower, that was sitting next to it. Oh, what happened? I lost it. Oh, I lost it. What I did is I did a blow up on this, and it actually shows this with the antenna, and there was our antenna down there. You get a phone call, they're off the air. Okay, what happened? The antenna came down. The antenna fell off the tower. No, the tower came down. The antenna's in fine shape. It's just on the ground. Okay. There, I ran out of time. Any quick questions? I think just anything at all? Oh, way in back. One question.
It's a good thing when you get a tower crew up, when you can get them up. But we have, at the place where I just retired from, they have adopted a policy because of the inconsistency and, frankly, shoddy work of tower crews with which we've had experience, that everything that's done on the tower and any possible irregularities be photographed by the tower crew. It's in the contract. And I cannot stress enough that that needs to happen in this day and age. Enough said.
Thank you for your attention. It's always a pleasure. And we have a booth back there, and come see me and I'll buy you a beer or whatever. Thank you. Thank you.